On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we are rolling out the misery porn for The Handmaid's Tale Season 3, trying to remember events that happened in 1998 for Netflix's revival of Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City, and finally getting to watch Killing Eve Season 2. Now that the Americans are done with it, the BBC have pulled their act together and the show is making its triumphant arrival on British TV. I'm James Dyer and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, a show that won't be reviewing the new season of Fear the Walking Dead this week due to what can only be described as zombie racism on the part of my two co-hosts. That's right, I'm calling you out. You are undeadist.
No one cares.
What is happening?
That's what I'm saying.
James is complaining that we're not reviewing Fear the Walking Dead season whatever. What is it? Season
78?
Yeah. Yeah, see what this discrimination? This discrimination against the Walking Dead franchise?
It is.
I've got a review. Shy.
That's right. Fine. All right. Well, first among this pair of dead-hating pro-lifers? No, that doesn't really work, does it? The first of you two is a woman who, in the event of a zombie apocalypse, would, I think, do surprisingly well, I'm saying.
Yeah, I would.
She would swiftly establish, I'm saying, a compound of strung-out survivors who carry out her every twisted command, and you would rule over the post-apocalyptic wasteland of London like a feudal warlord, only in impractical shoes. You're Negan, is what I'm saying.
What are you going on about?
Who was the listener who accused you of bullying me?
Somebody who clearly needs to pay closer attention to this show, because I wouldn't say bullying you, I'd say giving you what you deserve.
Did you or did you not, seconds before we went live, threaten to throw hot tea in my face?
This is factually true.
I mean, it was a hypothetical. Hypothetically, I really wanted to throw hot tea in your face and watch it melt off your skull.
Uh-huh.
But yeah. It was a hypothetically, I'd really like to throw hot tea in your face. Whoa. And watch your skin come off your skull.
It's Terry White.
Hi.
Joining Terry, Negan and myself is a man who I think I'm safe in saying would fare less well if the dead rose from their graves. Armed only. No, it's nothing to do with your height. I'd say armed only with an exclusive wardrobe and a cadre of famous friends, many of whom, let's be honest, would be surely be zombified by this point. I see you kind of leaving the cast early, but getting a really good death scene. You know, sort of like you'd be gnawed on by zombie Dermot O'Leary or kind of undead Jodie Whittaker. That's how I think. You know, not ideal, but memorable.
That's fair enough.
It's Boyd Hilton. Hello.
Thank you.
That Rolodex would be a very good weapon.
Well, that's true, yeah.
That's true. You could beat them to death.
Rolodex
death is a good, that's a good idea, yeah.
Good band name. We are Rolodex death.
That's a great band name. John Wick 4, Rolodex death scene.
Indeed. Right. So, moving.
Oh, we're rambling on.
Hastily on.
Your introduction.
Yeah. All right, fine. So, what have you two dreadful humans been watching?
Fuck knows. Do you know what? I'm...
Wow.
That is brilliant.
This is going to be a short podcast.
And also, that was said as if, how dare you ask that question?
Okay. Do you know why I got really angry at him in my head then? Because we have been on press
forever.
We've been on press with Empire and the next issue of Pilot, have we not?
We have.
And it was a 4-day week because of the bank holiday. So the reason I was looking at you with absolute fury is because I was like, how dare he ask me this? He knows what my life has been. But what I will say is that I have been watching the Thatcher documentary series on BBC. Thatcher, A Very British Revolution, which is about the rise and fall of Margaret Thatcher. I am the granddaughter of a miner, so I don't know why I thought this was a way to relax over the long weekend, but very good documentary series. Did not make me like Margaret Thatcher more, but who knew? Very good. Magazine's gone to press.
She didn't come out as an unlikely hero in this particular...
No, I mean, the unlikeliest hero ever. No, she did not.
Okay, all right, fine. Boy, what have you been watching?
Right, Chernobyl.
Yes.
We reviewed the first... Well, we reviewed as much... Have we seen the first two, I think, when we reviewed
when
it?
We reviewed it, yeah.
When
yeah,
it started, yeah. We interviewed
Jared.
The great Jared Harris. I've now watched the whole thing. Fucking hell is all I can say. I actually think this is up there now. It reminds me, what were you saying last week about When They See Us? You know,
yes.
That incredible show, the Ava DuVernay it's a similar, has a similar impact for me, Chernobyl now. If when you watch the whole thing, it is absolutely incredible. And they both, and I think what they've got in common is they take this true story, which for individuals involved was absolutely, obviously life-changing, disastrous, life-ending for many people in the case of Chernobyl. And it's told in such an incredibly authentic, brilliantly made way, and actors and everything. It's like, I can't even begin to see how they went about making these shows. And with Chernobyl, it's incredible. By the end of it, honestly, you've got to finish watching it, because I think it's like up there now with like some of the best TV ever made. I really do. It's so extraordinary. And the way it kind of looks at every single element of it. So there's a whole, you know, in the final episode that kind of explains what happened. There's a kind of meticulous explanation of every single step of the way. It is incredible. So Chernobyl, you've got to see the whole thing.
But have you become more impressed with it as it's gone on?
Yeah,
because I know you liked it, right? But you weren't
really liked it.
Quite so effusive.
I think it's, as it goes on, the achievement of it is it hits home more and more. Yeah, just because. Because the first episode plunges you into the incident, and that's very much a unique thing. And then each episode has a different kind of way of dealing with it. It might focus on individuals, you know, what happened to them. Then in the end, it's focusing on the whole big picture and the court case surrounding it. It's just unbelievably brilliant. So yeah, Chernobyl. And I want to quickly mention The Last Watch. Have you seen? Have you heard? So The Last Watch is a documentary about Game of Thrones. Made by Jeannie Finlay, and Sky put this in the schedule really late in the day, because I didn't know about this before. Even be like, it was very close to going to press, you know, with my weekly magazine.
Yeah.
And now it's on Sky Atlantic Now TV. You can watch it on Catch Up. It's fucking brilliant as well. Have you seen it?
I haven't, but it's on my watch list for the weekend.
I think just because it shows you, again, from all the different people's point of view, there's an extra who gets quite a lot of screen time in it. A kind of Irish guy who's been in the show from the first beginning, in extra and different kind of sex within the Game of Thrones universe. There's, you know, you see Kit Harington giving a speech on his last day, and he's doing his last thing that's so moving, especially subsequently now what's happened to him. You know, he's gone into rehab effectively. And I don't want to speculate on his mental health or anything, but you see how absolutely intense he is about the whole experience. And there's an incredible table read scene, which includes the moment when Varys dies and Paul Conniff-Hill, is that his name?
Yeah, Conniff-Hill.
They're like, his colleagues, like, and he's holding on to him because he's about to cry and is so moved by his own death scene. And there's Daenerys this being stabbed by Jon Snow. They read that bit and she's like grinning and he's like crying as well. It's so brilliant to see. And I think it ran the point home to me, which is that, again, I think those people who want it remade, you know, all these morons so furiously unhappy with it. It's like, just watch this and you'll see they were doing what they thought needed to be done with the show. And the achievement is incredible. So yeah. That's
when they did the table read for that bit, you know, was it all the dialogue from the show, or did he, for example, say to her,
know,
I know we didn't earn this from a character arc point of view, but I'm going to kill you anyway. Was that part
Fuck
of it?
Off. No. And
you
I think,
do
you know
far.
What? You pushed me too far. And I am going to say this now. I was holding back, but this documentary underlines everything that I was right about and you're wrong about. So put that in your pipe and smoke.
Oh, fun.
What have you been watching, James?
See, I don't really have a lot to bring to the table.
Have you been rewatching the rewatch of the rewatches?
I am now into halfway through season 5 of Sons of Anarchy, so I'm storming ahead with this one. I've got to the point where it gets a little darker when Jax takes over the club, and I think we're in the kind of like the slight downslope now for Sons of Anarchy, which is a shame because I've gone through the best of it. It's because they keep Ron Perlman along, frankly, they keep him around longer than they needed to. Don't you agree? You agree, don't you?
Yeah.
So that's good. I also watched the episode Data Law from season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation, which, as with all the Star Trek The Next Generation episodes I've watched recently, has not aged well and is a bit shit. That's the first one where you meet Data's twin brother, Law, and of course, Boyd, as you all know, the first encounter with the crystalline entity. So that's pretty good stuff.
I mean, whatever.
Yeah. And that was it, really.
We're being filmed, by the way.
Yeah, well, I don't know why. Terry, since we've done this podcast, Terry has sat here. She took at least half a dozen selfies, and now she's filming me and Boyd for I can only imagine what
for
reason.
For her own joy.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a late night entertainment for me. Know what I mean?
Okie dokie. Speaking of which, let's move on to Funny or Dire, for which I watched something this week, which I have been putting
still
off
going
for a very long time.
Hang on. Stop. The the point of Funny or Die It is that you choose and then we all watch it and then we all talk about it. You appear to have forgotten to tell me and Boyd.
You've totally gone well, rogue.
In another shit show of a franchise from James.
No, I will point out that on numerous occasions did I tell you in advance what we were doing, and neither of you at any point made any effort to watch them regardless.
That is so totally
not
true.
Absolutely the case. And so I just now press on with it solo because I know you won't watch it. Okay, next week I'll give you one to watch and we'll see if you watch it.
But do carry on.
I will. Right. I'm fine. I'm going to include Boyd because I can guarantee, I'm willing to stake Boyd's life on the fags.
Wow.
That you definitely haven't watched this.
Is it something geeky? Is it got spaceships and fucking like fantasy witches, goblins?
I mean, all of the above.
Yeah.
But Boyd, how do you feel about Rick and Morty?
Oh, yeah. Do you know what? I've never really got into Rick and Morty, but obviously I'm aware that it's really good. Yeah.
Some of the Empire Office was obsessed with it. You used to talk about it an awful lot. I'd never watched any episodes of it. So, at Kingery said to me, I should watch Rick and Morty, Season 3, Episode 4, Vindicators 3, The Return of World Ender. That was the episode title.
Mm.
And I watched it.
And?
So, here's the thing.
God.
So,
he has notes.
Rick and Morty is something that has passed me by. Like, I haven't really read reviews. I don't know what it is that people like about it. I know there's something to do with Szechuan sauce or something that I don't really understand. And there's a pickle Rick is a thing. I don't know what that is either.
Don't know either.
These are all jokes from the show that I don't understand. So I know it is a thing, but I've never really understood, you know, I know who's involved, but I don't know what it is that people like about it. So I was like, oh, what is it? Is it like Futurama? Like, what is it? Mm. So I watched it. It's clever. It's smartly written. It's very observant. But it is extremely smug and annoying, which I didn't like, which is ironic, as I myself am both smug and annoying. And yet, I didn't just not like it. Like, it irritated me to the point where I wanted to punch it. Like, I really hated it. Like, I found it the antithesis of funny.
Is the antithesis of funny not funny?
I mean, yeah, but it's anti-funny. It's like it sucks humour out of you. Like, if you had any residual humour energy in your body, like, this would suck it out of you and you would be left devoid of joy and humour.
It is genuinely guarded. I mean, it's passed me by as well, to be honest, but I always feel guilty that I never got into it. I've watched one or two episodes, but it is regarded by the, if I can use the phrase, comedy cognoscenti. You know those people,
yes,
those slightly snobby people who think they know everything about comedy.
Comedy
cunts. They love it. Yeah, you know, like, comedy fans, comedy nerds. They
comedy
do love
cunts.
It. Comedy cunts, yeah. This is one example where if you had shared, which as Terry pointed out, is the point of the whole fucking franchise, I would have watched it. It would have been quite interesting.
Okay. Well, I mean, the main reason I didn't tell you is I watched it last night at about 2 in the morning,
I see.
Having not had time to do it beforehand.
Oh, I get it. Right.
And at that point, Terry hadn't even watched the stuff she's supposed to review for this episode. And I thought I'd probably get punched if I suggested it, or, I don't know, hot tea thrown in my face. but I will accept that this is probably a really, really good thing. And it's and I can see that it's clever. I can see it's really well written, and it probably is a great comedy show. It's just, I think it's because it's the antithesis of what I find amusing. Like, it's and this will sound reductive, but it's puerile and stupid. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's deliberately, like, that's what they're going for. That's the sense of humor, but that is just not what I find funny.
Did you see the Netflix series that was made by Matt Groening of Simpsons?
The fantasy one.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was absolutely shockingly terrible.
I can't be dealing with that either. Yeah. I just,
I only mentioned it as another thing that people said, oh, that's really good.
I'm perfectly willing to say, in this case, this wasn't funny to me, but then this is me. So I'm not condemning all Rick and Morty fans, but let's be honest, I am judging you a bit.
I bet we get responses from Rick and Morty fans.
Oh, we will, because Rick and Morty's huge. Like, people love it. Like, it's a phenomenon, but it is a phenomenon that is lost on me, as so many things are. So, sorry, Kingery. Rick and Morty did not do the trick. Better luck next time if you want to hurl comedy in my general direction and,
like, hot tea.
And watch it burst into flames, then by all means do at me at James C. Dyer on Twitter and suggest both a series and, crucially, an episode. And now, news. First up in news, first order of news, is a bit of congratulations.
Thanks.
Liv Kelly from... Boyd. Liv Kelly from Ireland, who won the signed Game of Thrones print in our inaugural pilot competition. There you go. Well done, Liv.
That's another thing that Terry and I didn't know about until it suddenly arrived.
This
in the
is another something James has blagged somehow.
Hang on, I didn't get to keep it. I sent it to Ireland.
What did you get for this?
Nothing at all. I got nothing. Not a thing.
So what are we doing it for?
I got the admin of having to send it to Ireland.
I mean, I hate to have an editorial discussion live on air, but this seems like a foolish competition to have run.
Well, Liv seemed very, very happy with it.
Well, I'm sure she did.
She messaged me this morning to say it had arrived. The raven has landed was actually what she said.
Oh, goodness.
I've yet to draw the runner-up prize, who will receive one of Terry's famous ham and cheese sandwiches, but we'll get onto that at some point later. Right, give me some news, Terry.
Gavin and Stacey Christmas special!
This was something lots of people were very, very, very excited about.
Yeah, like, not
the Twitter
you,
thread
I saw.
For this was nuts.
Not you, I saw. So James Corden put a picture of the script, which said, Gavin and Stacey Christmas special 2019, created by James Corden and Ruth Jones, who obviously wrote the previous series. Mm. There's been one Christmas special before, which was immense, and I actually only watched it coincidentally the other week. I absolutely fucking love Gavin and Stacey. I don't know if it reminds me of that kind of time in my life. I was in my late 20s. It's like every time I hear like the Libertine songs they play, and it like proper makes me think about being young and about the time before this country was completely and utterly fucked. So it's slightly halcyon days whenever I watch Gavin and Stacey. Obviously, James Corden has gone on to do great, big, huge things in the US. Ruth Jones has made some interesting telly since then, right?
She's a best-selling novelist.
Is she really?
Yes, she is, yeah.
There we go. I, for one, I'm like beside myself. We know it's 9 years since the last one. Obviously, when we left them in the very last episode, Stacey was pregnant. Netta hadn't gone through with her marriage to Dave. Like, they left it in a lovely open way, and the speculation was always they're leaving it ripe for some kind of revisiting down the line. Almost 10 years. I think it's going to be amazing. I think those two together, I think Ruth Jones and James Corden are dynamite together. I really do. Writing. I think James Corden is really, really, really funny on telly. I really do. And I can't wait. And I'm dead excited. And the bloody Twitter thing was brilliant because he announced it and all the replies were people posting either GIFs or memes, or there was a episode of Gavin and Stacey Set at Christmas where Smithy played Band-Aid, and it's like a brilliant, brilliant bit of telly, and it was so joyful, wasn't that you? Did you go through this thread?
Yeah.
Wasn't it brilliant? Everybody was so excited and so happy.
I added to it by pointing out that I am in the opening scene of Gavin and Stacey Christmas special.
You are finger in the
knicker, the knickers. I'm not sniffing them. I'm ordering them. I'm an employee. I'm an M&S employee in the opening scene. It was one of the great honours.
I thought it was Debenhams.
No, M&S. Ooh. M&S. I cannot agree more. It's incredibly exciting. And what, for all kinds of reasons, the actual thing is incredibly exciting, that this absolutely brilliant show that started out as a small thing on BBC Three and grew into this huge public, huge phenomenon, pop culture phenomenon on BBC One. James, you're still looking mystified by the whole thing. It's exciting that is back because it was so brilliant. And as you say, the two of them are fantastically talented. And also, the way they've kept it secret, I think, is incredible. Because hardly anything's kept a secret of this magnitude in TV in this day and age. So it was very exciting that it suddenly arrived, that he tweeted a picture of the script. And I heard various cast members talking about it on the radio and how they've read the script and how they think it's fantastic already. Yeah, it's going to be a massive, massive treat at Christmas. I cannot wait.
I didn't watch Gavin and Stacey.
I mean, who is surprised by that?
So, honestly, I don't think you'll like it because you're you, but I love it. I've got such a huge amount of affection for it.
I think you might like it. It's good.
He won't.
Do you think I should? It should
do you
be
like
another
early Mike Lee or, you know, films or that they were a big influence on? Alison Steadman, it was in.
Pam is one of the great comedy figures in British telly.
Exactly.
She has some of the best lines going.
Fantastic, yeah. Right. This is a show that's got Julia Davis, Rob Brydon, and Alistair Steadman in supporting roles. Yeah. You know, it's an incredible piece of TV.
Oh, that whole the Heat episode where Pete and remind me of Julia Davis's character's
name.
Can't
remember her name.
And they're the couple who live next door.
Yeah.
And basically they meet a guy on the internet and he comes and meets them in the local restaurant. They'd sent him a picture from like 20 years before. Yeah. I think that's episode one, season two, because it's the day they come back from the honeymoon.
Yes, yes, yes.
Maybe, so, do you know what? Try season two, episode one.
This is next week's Funny or Die. As we speak. Yeah.
Season you've got two, to watch. Oh, you have to remind me.
Season two, episode one. And if you don't like season two, episode one, which is the episode when they return from their honeymoon and it's almost entirely set in the local Italian restaurant, then I've got nothing for you.
Okay. Mm. Sounds like a challenge.
Yes, that is the main news. Have you read, and you must have read, because your finger's on the nub of literature, Terry. Well, Normal People, the book?
Sally Rooney. No.
Ah. Well, anyway, Normal People, which is a bit of a literary phenomenon and has been a massive success for the author Sally Rooney, is being turned into a big 12-part drama for BBC, and it's starring Daisy Edgar-Jones and as Marianne and Paul Mescal as Connell. It's a modern love story, and to show you how kind of quality this is going to be, it's directed by Lenny Abramson, is that how you pronounce his name? Of Room fame.
Mm-hmm.
And Hetty MacDonald, who directed Howard's End, which was brilliantly directed, the BBC drama. And it's exciting. James, have you got some nerdy sci-fi bullshit that you want to tell us about?
Yeah, have you had Peep Show? It's getting a a remake.
Yes.
A gender-swapped US remake.
Ugh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is happening on FX. Sam Bain actually was one who mentioned this. So clearly he's involved in this, but he mentioned that a new version is on FX with the main roles being played by women. So there you go. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because Peep Show is another show I've never seen.
Oh, God. Oh, that's a future. Another future Funny or Die. Yeah. Do.
It's funny because we had Sam Bain on the Empire podcast once, and I can't remember. I think I might have confessed to him that I'd never seen.
I remember that episode of the he was great, and I even to Jesse Armstrong, and you don't like Succession either, do you? Because you've got a man of bad taste.
Yes,
which is a brilliant show
That's
created
right.
by the other people show creator.
I don't enjoy.
Who is interviewed by
Succession.
Me in the next issue of Pilot TV magazine.
Okay, good.
But FX stuff is generally good. I would be down on this. I'd be like, oh, gender swap of people show, blah blah blah. If it was like going to be on NBC or something, but FX stuff is generally pretty good quality.
Yeah, it is. FX is a good one. I've got some. Arnold Schwarzenegger is doing Superhero Kindergarten, which is an animated show where he is doing what sounds a lot like Detective John Kimball from Kindergarten Cop.
No,
it's not. So it's not. It's in Bonnie on set. It's not a. It's not a sequel to Kindergarten Cop. It's just very similar to it. So he plays Arnold Armstrong, who's kind of like a retired superhero who used to be called Captain Courage, and he's now in retirement and he's a teacher. He's lost all his superpowers fighting his arch nemesis, Dr. Superior, who I clearly identify with.
Oh my God, that is your nickname.
Dr. Superior would absolutely be my supervillain name. And so that's a weird thing that's happening, but not as weird as the fact that Sylvester Stallone has announced that 1986 incredibly violent film Cobra, in which crime was a disease, and lest we forget, he was the cure.
Cobra's amazing.
Is getting a streaming series.
Yes, I saw this.
Yes, indeed.
How?
I don't know. It's a film in which Sylvester Stallone plays Marion Cobra Cabretti and has to take out Brian Thompson's serial killer. I believe it's called the Night Stalker or something. But anyway, so this is getting a streaming remake, and it's going to become a thing that will appear on our streams.
On your streams.
Yes.
Have you watched the trailer for The Dark Crystal?
I have.
Oh my God.
I have.
So I could not have cared less about this show. And even though we've run about 84 stories on it in both Empire and Pilot TV, and then I watched the trailer.
Looks really
and
good.
It looks.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Like, it really evokes the feel of the original film.
But like, with like,
really does.
Proper big budget and like a kind of epic.
But also in that sign of slightly, because it's all puppetry.
Here's my question. Because in one of the many pieces that we're running about this show in Pilot TV Magazine and Empire, the director Louis Leterrier says there's no CGI in this. Now, you watch that trailer. Of course there is. There's definitely CGI
I feel like maybe he means there's no computer-generated like characters. Because CGI is used to take out like people.
Yeah.
They must use CGI just for smoothing stuff over. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe he's telling the truth, but... Really?
Maybe I don't believe that. Slightly being unfair, but I'm sure he very much emphasised it's definitely, you know, in camera.
But they are puppets.
They're in camera puppets, and all of that.
But it really, really brought back, frankly, PTSD. Like, I had flashbacks. Like, my childhood trauma was living large when I saw that, because it really reminded me of that film, which freaked me the fuck out when I was a kid. I was there for the scoring session of that film. Of the Dark Crystal. It was my mum worked at the recording studio where it was scored.
Wow.
And I remember watching them do it and then having nightmares for the next 10 years of my life.
Weird personal connection to the score of Dark Crystal.
Me and Fizzgig, we go back a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
Marvel's Jessica Jones season 3 has a date.
Oh,
are you excited enough for me to tell you, or shall I just move on?
No one cares.
It's June the 14th. Right, there you go.
I mean, this could not. What we should say is Netflix literally, shut it out. No one cares. We can't even be bothered anymore.
It's in two weeks. Nobody cares.
No one gives a shit.
What if it's the best season yet?
I mean, there's
what if
13 hours. This is 13 hours. Some people have created 13 hours of probably quite expensive.
Yes.
Probably took months and months, if not years, to write. And it's been kind of like, oh, there it is.
Unless we forget, season one of Jessica Jones, I would argue, the best individual series that in the Marvel Netflix partnership.
Yeah, maybe.
So this could be, it could be them going out on a high. But then season two of Jessica Jones, I thought was rubbish. So I don't know.
Yeah.
We shall see. Gentleman Jack has been renewed for a second series. That is nice. Please about that.
That is nice.
Well, it is. It's good.
And Lars Stone and Halifax will be back in 2020 talking of Sally Wainwright things.
Okay. Good, good, good. Now let's move on to what we like to call the reviews, where we review the TV shows. First up this week, you have the return of Happy Go Lucky Laugh Riot, The Handmaid's Tale. Yeah. After two seasons of torture, rape, sexual repression and abuse, we are back for more. Returning to Gilead, aka Mike Pence's America, after June voluntarily stayed there at the end of season two, giving up her one chance at freedom to try and save her daughter Hannah and bring it all down from the inside, we can only assume. I am right in saying I think we all gave up on this at some point during season two.
Yeah. Yes.
None of us made it through. How many did you make in, Terry?
I think I made it... Five.
Oh, okay.
I made it quite far.
Yeah, similar, five or six.
I think three and I was out.
Right.
Just, it got to the point, and so before watching this first episode of season three, I read the in-depth episode breakdowns of all of season two.
Mm.
And it genuinely feels like that was a season without a great deal of plot momentum that was just designed to make you as upset as humanly possible. Like, it was just layering on gratuitous misery. I mean, that might be slightly overstating it, but certainly that's how it reads on the page. It doesn't seem like, you know, it wasn't a laugh riot, was it?
No. No, but I watched episode one of season three, and I have to say, it immediately felt different to me. So I remember very vividly seeing episode one of season two and finding it immensely traumatic.
With
so
the gallows.
The gallows in the middle of the playing field, all in muzzles, as they played A Woman's Worth. Like, it was, I mean, there was nothing like, there was no light touch about it. It was oppressive and incredibly traumatic. And this felt quite different. I mean, there is an extraordinary use of I Don't Like Mondays, which is one of the best uses of that song
the
ever.
The Boomtown Raps montage I was not expecting.
Oh my God. And there is it's still, don't get me wrong, like, there is still, it's still incredibly difficult to watch in places. It's still terribly upsetting in places. But there is a difference in the tone of the characters somehow. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but it feels less kind of fully oppressive to the point where it was unwatchable before, I think.
She feels more empowered,
June,
I think.
Yes.
Yeah, June feels like she has a measure of control. Even while she's suffering dignity, even when she faces abuse, she faces it like knowingly and just walks into it with a kind of like, fuck you attitude.
Mm.
I think they've spoken about this, haven't they? I feel this is a direct response to the criticisms of season two. Because I don't know what their ratings look like at the end of two, but I think, certainly anecdotally, a lot of people fled the show the second season.
Yeah, I was interested to the extent to which they have responded to the criticism. Mm. Because sometimes you think, is it... I mean, some creators of drama, films, TV, very much are of the take the stance, no, I'm not going to respond to audience opinion. You know, I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm writing it for myself, blah, blah, blah. You know, that is a thing that people say. I think it's good. I feel like they have absolutely responded because you have got moments of lightness. That the Boomtown Rats moment is so, where is this coming from? And you also have moments, I think it absolutely actually helps that one, some characters have escaped to Canada.
Yes. Yes.
And so that feels like the scenes there in Canada, like, oh, I feel like, literally like a load off my back, because they think good things are happening to those characters. And as you say, she's more empowered now because she did, it was controversial that at the end of the last season, she could have escaped herself and didn't, took the decision not to. But I feel that has empowered her and I feel that is working as well. So I did really enjoy this first episode as well. And
you're completely right though. I'd never thought about that. The moment when, and there is a character particularly who makes it through and the relief and the hope that gives you, whereas I remember there was one point last season where she'd escaped and got captured again, and it was like there were three or four episodes where there wasn't a glimmer of hope or positivity in the entire thing, you know, because it was cutting to the help me out, where they did all the graft.
The colonies.
Yes. So it was cutting between, you know, what you already thought was awful, which was the handmaids, you know, in the houses. Actually, they then created something
even worse,
100 times worse in the colonies. And there were some episodes that were 50% in the colonies. And you were just watching women die, like living in awful brutality.
Alexis Bledel's teeth falling out.
And you know, there was some, from a cinematography perspective, they were absolutely some of the most beautiful scenes on television last year, but they were unrelenting, a new level of bleak that I hadn't even experienced in season one. And you're right, actually, because the different palette and kind of landscape that that freedom gives you is it doesn't feel like, oh fuck, everybody's going to die and I'm just going to sit here watching people die week after week.
And Bradley Whitford, who, I mean, you know,
Bradley Whitford,
I think he's foregrounded in more in this episode. He did arrive in the last series, but he's just got an immediately kind of slightly comedic version of the horrible men. So he's already more interesting to me than the slightly, I think, one-dimensional men in some of the, not all of them, but some of them.
Yeah,
Joseph Fiennes' character. I never that interested in his character.
No, he doesn't have a lot.
Whereas this guy is different and interesting and kind of got little interesting edges to him.
No, I agree. I think the tone is different. I think Elizabeth Moss is, as she has been throughout, incredibly good in this. It's a magnificent performance. And I think this sort of steel that she's brought into June is really comes to the fore in this, which is great. Also, some really stunning shots in this. There's one where she's coming down the stairs, see some smoke, and there's a shot of a burning bed. Beautifully.
Oh, that whole fire thing.
As a metaphor, you know, the burning of this bed where terrible things have happened. I mean, there was also something interesting, really interesting, in the kind of theme of motherhood in this first episode. And actually, women who've previously, I don't want to give too much away, but women who've previously been pitted against each other finding common ground in the narrative of motherhood. And it being a great leveler between these women, because obviously in previous seasons they've been fiercely pitted against each other and enemies, and you now see these women kind of realizing that actually being mothers and the sacrifices you make and the pain you have to go through, and it's a shared trauma. They found a language in shared trauma, which is really interesting because it creates a more interesting relationship between the women, which isn't just this adversarial bitch versus bitch kind of dynamic. So I really love that as well.
Because it got, there were parts in season two where it just got unspeakably grim for everyone. Serena Joy, who's been consistently awful to June throughout, gets her own finger cut off for daring to read from the Bible aloud, because of course women are not allowed to read in Gilead. The dynamic between those two, I think, is going to be a real crux of this season. I think it's going to be very, very interesting. And I get the impression that this is finally going to be an attempt to kind of fight back and deconstruct it. I was quite surprised by how negatively a lot of people on the internet took the finale of season two, where she elects to stay in Gilead, about, oh, it's ridiculous. And I was like, of course she was going to stay. Why did you ever think she was going to leave? Because her daughter's there. It doesn't make any sense.
And to your point, I actually think there's a couple of scenes in this first episode with Serena Joy which are remarkable, actually. And I think she's incredible. You know, Elizabeth Moss is one of the finest actors working today, and she puts in amazing scene after amazing scene. But there is an incredible scene with Serena where you see how they've all been leveled by shared trauma, and she is incredible. And actually, it's Fred, and it's, you know, who's out in the kind of wilderness by himself, isolated from this thing that he can't possibly relate to. And as you say, there are a couple of shots. There's one really early on, and there's the flaming bed one, and they are absolutely remarkable.
So there's a rally for The Handmaid's Tale, I'm going to say. And if people have watched, as a lot of people will have done, if they've watched season one and they've skipped season two, I actually don't think it's a bad thing to jump straight back in with season three. The Wikipedia breakdowns of season two, you can read through in about 10 minutes.
And there's a catch-up in the beginning.
There is a very brief catch-up at the beginning. So it gives you the key points of what's happened.
Yeah.
But you can, if you want to delve into the misery properly, then the Wikipedia page is probably the way to do it.
And I didn't catch up on the end of season two. So I just went straight into season three, and I have to say it was pretty...
Yeah.
You know, it's,
you can figure it out.
Clear figure what's going, it out. Yeah.
Audience knows a load of shit happened to a load of characters and they're all pretty miserable. And then we pick up. It's all good. That is The Handmaid's Tale Season 3, which airs on Channel 4 on Sunday the 9th of June at 9 p.m. Also out this week is Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City. This is based on the literary series of the same name, but more specifically, picking up the pieces of the kind of on-again, off-again TV adaptation, which began back in 1993, continued in 98 and 2001, but it's been away from our screens for the past 18 years. This one picks up with Laura Linney's Marianne Singleton and Olympia Dukakis' Anna Madrigal as Linney comes back to this tight-knit San Francisco community at 28 Barbary Lane. And I have to say, I had no idea what was happening.
Oh my God. I would. Do you know what?
All.
When I was watching this, I was thinking, I really wish I had a live stream to James Dyer's face right now. Like, trying to work out what was happening.
I have never read the books. I have never seen any of the previous series. And you go into this, and I was led to believe that this was like, okay, it's been away for 18 years. We can't assume people have watched this. You're going to be able to come into this cold, and it'll be very easy to get into. Like, it assumed so much knowledge of who these people were. I'm like, who the fuck are you? What is this? Why are you upset? Why are you giving her the face? And why are you in a strop? And she's your mother? And oh no, she's not. And hello? And also, why is it this woman's birthday? And why is everyone hanging around here? It's like, this is like, who lives like this?
Why is it weird... this woman's birthday? No, but
like, it's like they all live in this sort of block and everyone's hanging out and it's all like an episode of
That's
Friends.
That's the whole thing. And they're, like, they're all living in the block and hanging
it's
out.
Very
That's the premise.
Confusing. So have you, right, so have you two watched the previous three miniseries?
No.
Okay, so you went into this cult.
And I was just going to leap to James's defense, which is, I saw watching it and thought I was accidentally watching episode two because there were so many bits missing. Yeah. So then I went and Googled and read all up on, because I didn't even realise it was meant to be a sequel to, you know, and Laura Linney is picking up a character that she first played 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I had no knowledge of all of this. So I was equally as confused. I was like, what is happening? And so I had to go and research it before I started watching it. So I do think James has a point, which is there is an assumption of knowledge, which I think is fine as long as it still works within the context of your own show. I think this is hard to watch if you don't know the plot, if you don't understand that it's a sequel, if you don't understand who Laura Linney's character is. I think James has a point.
Could I get that in writing?
Oh my God.
Like, can we make a time and date here?
Beautiful. I have watched probably all of the previous series. I don't remember them at all. I mean, okay. I didn't brush up on it. So I think I had a similar, I guess, you know, there's a certain amount of assumed knowledge, but I do think actually they took the deliberate dramatic decision to plunge you in and let you work it out anyway. Do you know what I mean? So even if, I don't think many of us who watch, I mean, maybe some obsessives have probably rewatched it, like you rewatch everything, single thing you ever see, are exactly aware of what happened, but I wasn't, I couldn't remember at all. And I immersed myself in it and I kind of got along with the things I didn't remember and I just accepted it and moved on, if you like. But I think the tone and mood of it is what is important, and that's what I remember from watching it first time, which is it is a celebration of community, of in quotes freaks. And so Laura Linney's character is the outsider in this community of outsiders because she's normal and white and middle class, and that's the whole thing. That was the brilliant concept of it from Armistead Maupin's original thing, is that yes, it's all about San Francisco and different people with, you know, with sexuality and ethnicity and all of that, but actually the main character is very much white bread all American girl, and they've that's what is the really interesting way that he goes at it, because then she's still very much in that mindset. Her husband even more so. He's the one who calls them freaks. The community living in San Francisco that they go back and see because of this leadership figure's birthday, 90th birthday. She's the one who gathered these people around in her block. And I thought that is still, I think, really works really well, because there's an edge to Laura Linney's character that I kind of forgotten about a bit, which is that she, in the end, she does care a lot, even though she loves being among this community of outsiders. outsiders, but she kind of actually also really embraces her mainstreamness. And she's got this really nerdy square husband who clearly doesn't approve of that world. So that clash, I think, is interesting, because I think it could just be a kind of like a quite a kind of, in a way, hippie-ish celebration, you know, of San Francisco and the community. But actually, there's more to it than that. So I thought it was really interesting. And I think the amazing thing is, she is still kind of looks exactly the same as she did 20 years ago. Still a brilliant presence in the middle of it, this kind of charismatic figure. And I really enjoyed it.
But is there something tricky about it being 2019? The San Francisco of 2019 that we know it as is about capitalism, is fully about kind of like commercialism. It's very, I think it's been a long time since it's truly been considered a city for outsiders. I know that it still does have a large queer community, which is what this show celebrates and puts at the heart of it. And I think you're right. I think for that, it's still radical in many respects. It shouldn't be, but it's still radical to have a queer community at the heart of your show. Yeah. And as you say, for Laura Linney's character to be the outsider. Yeah. And it's still kind of remarkable that 20 years on, that's still radical, right? And that rarely happens. But I suppose the bit that I was struggling with is San Francisco in 2019, and actually a lot of America in 2019, is that still valid, that sense of it being that place for those... For people,
yeah, I know what you mean.
For people on the outside.
I know what you mean, yeah. I think it is kind of dealing with that and will deal with it more, is the sense I get. Because I think it's not regarding the characters as they're all great. Oh, isn't they're all wonderful? And isn't this world wonderful? I think it is looking at it with a certain sly side eye, if you like.
And there's a line where Zosia Mamet says something about basically like San Francisco being at this heart of capitalism.
Yes.
And there's definitely a reference to it.
Yeah, totally.
But it makes it feel weirdly nostalgic almost. And there's bits where it almost feels like fantasy, you know, with the fairy lights and the way it's shot, and it there's something weirdly nostalgic and throwbacky about it. I can't quite put my finger on it.
I think it's an interesting mix of nostalgia and throwbacky, and being quite and very pertinent about what's happening, because there's stuff about social media and Instagram. There's the transgender couple who are kind of chronicling their lives, and there's documentarists filming stuff. I thought all of that, it feels very current to me. And you know, I've only watched like 1.5 episodes, but I already feel like it's going to be more relevant perhaps than we might think. It feels very clever and smart the way it's dealing with present day situation.
I'll tell you what did drive me mad is there's an almost constant background music in the first 10 minutes, and it was very like sitcom-y, but it was very I can't put my I found it so distracting. Really distracting, because it sounded like twee elevator music, and I didn't know again if that was intentional, almost this kind of, you know, it is quite plasticky and fantasy and twinkly and, do you know what I mean? It's like this kind of candy-coloured confection that they've constructed. And we should actually say that Lauren Morelli is the showrunner of this, who was the writer on Orange is the New Black. And that actually, Armistead Maupin is an exec producer, right? Yep, so, you know, he's been involved.
And it's got Ellen Page in it, who's great.
Yeah, she's very good.
And as you say, Zosia Mamet, who I love, who's also really good.
So also, this feels like a somewhat... shall we say, sanitized version of his book series. Because I was reading up on the books. The second one's got cannibalism in it. I mean, it's properly off the rails.
I think you'll see it gets
there'll
less...
be cannibalism. We can look forward to
that. Yeah, no, not specific cannibalism, but I think it'll be more edgy as it goes on. Right. I think this is an introductory thing.
It felt cautious to me in places.
Yeah, I think it'll get less cautious.
There was, I could feel it like tiptoeing into stuff. And actually, I think for it to be really radical in that sense, you do hope it kind of pushes in, because there are, you know, some of the couples are quite even though they may seem kind of non-traditional, there's a certain kind of surface thing going on, which is you really want to get to know those characters and those dynamics and those relationships better, so they're not kind of this is the couple that are like that, this is, do you know what I mean, where they come to be types of something, but you don't really understand them as humans. But obviously we've got an entire season to get to know these characters and these people.
Indeed we do. That is Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City, and this drops on Netflix on Friday the 7th of June. Finally this week is a show we've been... Oh, hang on. No. I'm going to say... okay. Finally, this week is a show we've been waiting what seems like eons for, while the Americans drank their fill of it. News broke this week that Killing Eve had finally been given its UK release date, and it's here. It's this week. Yes, Villanelle is once again among us as season two picks up soon after the climax of season one. 30 seconds after, to be precise. Now, you two have already talked about this a little bit when you went to that preview event the other week. And I seem to recall, Terry, your love affair with season one felt like that some of the gloss had gone off it.
Well, it was. I think it was more I was very conscious of the fact that there was a new head writer in Emerald Fennell, and I loved season one and particularly the writing of season one so much, and I was really conscious of the fact that it wasn't Phoebe Waller-Bridge anymore. But Boyd often has pointed out that actually she didn't write all of the episodes in the first season, and that I was probably just being too hyper aware of that. Having seen the first two, it does feel different, and I think it should, because I think no woman wants to come in and do a carbon copy of the woman who went before her, right? It feels like it has enough shared ground in terms of, you know, those brilliant bits of absurd comedy, which we've very rarely seen before. There weren't enough of those for me. So I loved that there was, I think I've talked about this scene before, there was a scene where, you know, it picks up afterwards and she says, and Eve said, oh, I think I've killed Villanelle.
Yeah.
And there's a couple who happen to be proposing next to her, and she's like, oh, hi, sorry. And it's like those kind of, yeah, the clash of that normality and this, you know, there's this high drama happening here, and then she stumbled upon this other thing here. I missed a few of those. Mm. The second episode really picks up pace, and Villanelle is in hospital, I think we can say.
Yep.
And there is a very, 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 very shocking death, is fair to say.
Yep.
And then she ends up in England, and as it gathers, as the story moves on, I think it really found its rhythm, especially in episode two. I was really like, yeah. I understood the pace. The first episode, I found it a little bit kind of discombobulating. I had to find my groove within it. By the end of episode two, I was like, right, I get this now. I'm in it. I'm with you. Now I really want to see episode three. But I don't know what I was reacting to. Did you notice any difference?
Weirdly, the thing that struck me first of all is I had forgotten how much I delight in the tone of this show. Because it's like, it's serious, it's violent, but it has this through line of very subtle, incredibly pitch black humour to it. And it's really fucking funny.
Yeah.
Like, to the point where, like, Rick and Morty didn't even make me smile. Like, this, I laughed aloud several points watching this. It's particularly, so my favourite thing in the whole first season is always Fiona Shaw, because always Fiona Shaw.
Mm.
When she's like, you know, I saw a rat there drinking a can of Coke. Both paws. Quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, both hands.
That's quite a good impression.
Yeah. But, that is.
But genius. And then in this, she's got the thing. She's like, well, why do you look so good? She goes, it's my moisturiser. It was made of pig placenta. And she goes, it's cost a fortune. It smells like arse, but it's effective. And it just destroyed me. It's just, and then Sandra Oh just follows her going, I could smell like arse. I don't mind smelling like arse. And he was like, this is amazing. Like, it's really well written, but it's incredibly precisely delivered. And it takes incredible skill to walk that line, that tonal line between serious drama and this kind of slightly absurd comedy.
It is absurd.
And because of the drama, because it's juxtaposed with the drama, as I always bang on about, it makes it so much funnier. So I enjoyed episode one enormously, but episode two is magnificent. Just the sequence in the hotel, in the hospital, where she goes from the hospital, and the way that's, it's almost like a send up of a trope, really. Like, you know, and it's just the inversion of that and the power dynamic, which isn't where you would expect it to be in that particular situation. And I just reveled in it. I absolutely loved it.
I mean, there's a line in episode one where, or it may have been the start of episode two, where she's explaining that, she was stabbed by Evan, and she ends up going, oh, you will do crazy. What's the actual quote? She says, oh, when you love someone, you will do crazy things, with this wistful smile on her face while clutching the stab wound from where she'd been stabbed. I mean, Julian Barrett, we should mention in episode two, is
incredible.
Incredible. That episode could have been an entire series of something.
And it's like a standalone, almost like a brilliant thing, diversion. Mm. But that's the great thing, I think, about what they've created, because it allows, because you're so immersed in the incredibly blackly comic tone, which they achieved so brilliantly. And I do think Emerald Fennell has done a brilliant job, mm-hmm. because you're right, she's maintained the tone. And I still think, you know, if you didn't know that there were any changes of writing, you just crack on with it. Yeah. But there is something slightly different about her writing, I think. And it's difficult to put your finger on it. I feel there's slightly more visual jokes and visual kind of tricks played. I don't know. It's only seen in episode two when he arrives, the Julian Barrett character arrives. But it's so clever that you're immersing it, that actually the implausibilities, because what happens in episode two, slight spoiler, she ends up with this guy in his house and he's, you know, he's fucking crazy basically, you know, without putting too much point on it. And it's not that likely, is it, that you'd end up, you know, you'd chance upon this dude. But you completely go along with it because such is the brilliant handling of the tone of it. So fantastical thing. It's kind of a made to seem. You buy into it. And I watched episode three and it keeps, I was all like, for me, it's definitely keeping up the pace and it keeps up. And that relationship between Eve and Villanelle is still so brilliantly done as well, and that there's more of that in episode three. There's, you know, there's some couple of great new characters, I think, and your Fiona Shaw, I mean, and her son who works with that dude wearing shorts mysteriously for no reason whatsoever. It's so many great, brilliant, random things about the writing. I still love it. I still think it's absolute gold, TV gold.
And props to Jodie Comer for her accent work, which is flawless, but when everything she flows between them, it's magnificent.
Yeah. That episode two is, by the way, set mostly in Basildon. I mean,
of course.
It's made Basildon look quite, you know, interesting. It's so well done.
Yeah, I love how it's, you know, it goes from a Parisian bolt hole to literally Basildon.
Right.
Like it's to a supermarket in Basildon. It's, and you know, just the look of that house when she ends up in this house, it's just absolutely note perfect.
And isn't it interesting because they've already announced that season three will be mostly head writer is now Suzanne Heathcote, who you'll be excited to know worked on Fear the Walking Dead.
Yes.
One of the big executives.
Does that mean you're boycotting it?
No. What I'm saying is, so what they've done now, what they've made clear they're doing is they're going to hand over each season to a new female showrunner and head writer. And I think that's a really interesting thing. So they've made something very positive and interesting out of the fact that clearly people on the bridge is too busy to bloody do this show to write. You know, most episodes of the show, and I think that's a really interesting way of doing it. You should pitch in. You could do episode season.
So you're pointing at James.
I should do it.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yeah, Boyd, I'll do that. So Killing Eve season two, and this drops in the UK on BBC One on Saturday, June the 8th at 9:15 PM. But of course, if you're in America or Ireland or loads of other places, you've already seen them all.
But it's all available to watch all in one go from Saturday.
It is available all to watch in one go, so you can binge to your heart's content. Also out this week is the new series of Black Mirror, which we have seen. However, thanks to a particularly tricky embargo, we're not actually able to talk about it, so we can't review it for you. Luckily, though, we have the next best thing, as we got creators Annabelle Jones and Charlie Brooker to come in and talk about it instead. Boyd had a chat with this pair about what's in store for you all in the latest run of episodes, and this is what they said.
Charlie Brooker and Annabelle Jones, team of Black Mirror, welcome to the Pilot TV podcast.
Hello.
We are discussing the new fifth season of Black Mirror, three extraordinary new episodes. The first of which I'm going to ask you about is Striking Vipers, starring Anthony Mackie and Yahya Abdul-Mateen. Now, this episode touches on lots of fascinating themes, playing computer games, sexuality. I feel possibly a little bit of porn in there, isn't it?
Definitely.
Now, which
a lot of porn.
I don't know what porn is.
No, none
I've
of us
never
do.
Seen it.
What is it?
She's seen it. Annabelle's seen
it. Yes, women are allowed to say they've seen it.
Yes. Lots of research for Charlie in this film.
Now, which of those ideas came first? What was the trigger for this story?
First question is this go out post or pre?
Just before. Launch.
Just before. Yes. Okay, so I'm going to try. That's a tricky
Literally
one.
The day before, I think.
The day before. Okay. So without spoiling anything, it's kind of all of the above. I think it came about, there was an observation I'd had about the nature of, we had a conversation about pornography.
Right.
Because I was
about
like,
how you had to stop.
I was like, what is it? What is this stuff you keep talking about and relentlessly day in, day out that I've never heard of? And we were talking about what happens in the future when if you get sort of virtual porn and it's extremely realistic, what will that lead to? And so it sort of was born out of that. So the story then, I think, goes into unusual places off the back of that. And then also threaded in amongst that, there was some of my own observations about playing lots of video games, which are obviously fantasy worlds, and pornography is a sort of fantasy world. So it was like meshing the two together seemed like an interesting space to explore. It's a tricky one without saying.
It really is,
pre-launch, it's very hard for me to describe what happens in it.
Yes, but I'm going to say it does go some very interesting places with the game, without going through your way. And now, when you're casting these shows, I'm fascinated. So you've got great, these two great actors, the two main leads, and, and their wives and girlfriends as well. But
Nicole is also brilliant.
Yeah. She is brilliant. Is it an immediate yes? Do they kind of look at the script? Do they have, you know, is there stuff that they maybe have issues with in this one? Or was it kind of, they were pretty much on board with the whole white journey they go on?
I think an actor, when we have sent it to actors, they either enjoy it and there's something in there that they can relate to or something they want to explore, and if they are interested in the subject or the film, then we'll Skype and we'll talk it through. And if their interpretation of the film and if the things that they've enjoyed about it chime with us, then we sort of think, okay, we've got the right actor for the role. And we were lucky enough that Anthony enjoyed the script, and though, you know, there are questions in there about masculinity and the perceptions of masculinity and what happens when you get older and how you cope with maybe that diminished virility and all themes that he was interested in, and that often he doesn't get to explore because he is often, you know, cast as the alpha male. So for him, this was an opportunity to do something very different. And he really got it. And same with Yaya. They're sort of very lucky that, you know, because as Charlie was saying, we can't really go into too much detail, but Yaya's role in particular is sort of quite ambiguous. And his, God, I can't say too much. So we were really pleased that Yaya embraced that and welcomed the opportunity to explore this sort of unknown territory.
There is an extraordinary scene. It's also, as you said, looked at long, a kind of long-term relationships, doesn't it? And as you say, you know, virility and all of that. So there's a brilliant scene in I think maybe towards the end with the two main characters, the husband and wife, about in the restaurant where he's...
Yes.
And I felt that was a really interesting exploration of the limits of a long-term relationship. Was that always your idea to explore that as well? Or was that, did that come about as you were writing?
That was the meat of the story, was really, you know, what is the human impact of what's going on here on everyone involved, on all sides of this dilemma. This is me talking around it without explaining what's going on.
We should say that when you get to see it, the dilemma is absolutely fucking fascinating.
It inspires a lot of debate. And like, we still don't know, or I certainly still don't know where I stand on what exactly, in a way, the nature of what's going on. There's many, I keep changing my point of view on what's going on. But that scene in particular, in the restaurant, I think, you know, they're both doing an amazing job. Nicole really knocks it out of the park there. It's like very raw as well. And so it really, you know, there's a sort of lightning rod of emotion moment there that hopefully, you know, for what is quite a fantastical story in many ways, it's also a very grounded, you know, story about, there's a lot about loyalty and a pragmatic sort of form of love in there. So hopefully people are going to – I think it will inspire quite a lot of debate.
Oh, definitely.
People.
I immediately wanted to convene a discussion group about it.
To go, right, what do we think of that? Book group.
A book group, exactly.
A book group. And that's what we should have.
You should.
Let's have a
Moving on to Smithereens, which has got Andrew Scott, Damson Idris, Topher Grace. My question, again, we can't spoil anything, but there's an element of a big kind of social media company, an app kind of thing going on there, and the head of it. And I wonder whether he had anything in mind, especially because, can we say he's gone on a retreat?
We can certainly say that we didn't. There's the head of a big social media platform in it. And I oddly didn't do much research.
Exactly.
Like, partly deliberately, because then you can't get sued, probably. You wouldn't be worried about it. There's not much we can say. We probably can't say that he's got...
It's about...
The germ for that. Should we say that the starting point for that story. A, we always wanted to do one this season that was set very much in the present
yes,
day.
Yes, I was going to ask about that.
In the real very world present. And in Britain. Yeah. And also it was born out of an observation. Often we're just discussing potential story ideas. And it was literally an observation where I was describing how I'd got in an Uber, I think, the previous day. And as I often do, it was just on autopilot. I was just like staring at my phone, got in, the car drives off. And then after about 20 minutes, I was aware it stopped. And then I realized that the driver was out and was rummaging around in the boot.
Oh dear.
And I thought, I don't know who this guy is. I don't know where I looked out. I didn't know where I was. I thought, oh my God, what's going on? Mm. He brings out a bottle of water. He went, sorry, it's a hot day. I was thirsty. Didn't want to disturb you. You're on your phone. And we were discussing that. That was an experience we've all had where we sort of get in a car and immediately go down the rabbit hole of our phones and don't look up and see what's going on. And then that fed into all sorts of other conversations we were having. And hopefully that is then mirrored in the episode. That's the starting point for the episode. And then it sort of spreads out from there. So we see Andrew at the start and sort of his actions cast a load of ripples.
That, yeah, he's definitely not just getting some water.
He's Andrew definitely Scott. Not just, I can no. definitely say that. And he doesn't at any point get, I know he does get a bottle of water at one point.
Oh, actually, yeah, you're right. Yeah. We yeah. can say it's quite an, there are extraordinary performances in all blemish, but this, Andrew Scott, I mean, he's on a roll, isn't he? This is, he has to go to some fair, without, again, some extremes, doesn't he? Mm-hmm.
Yes, and given, is it a spoiler to say for most, of the film, he is in a car.
Yes.
So his stage is very limited. And yet he just, you know, totally absorbs you and you're so under his skin and feeling every emotion.
The problem is, I mean, the reason it's actor. A huge challenge is he is so physically ugly that it's very difficult for the viewer to be able to stare at him for any...
I mean, he became known as the ugly priest, didn't he?
That's what everyone... Notorious. Like, he's very ugly.
Yeah.
And, you know, fair
you
play to him.
Are objectifying him?
I'm negatively... I mean, he's a hideous man.
Yeah.
Like, everyone objectifies Andrew Scott now. I think
and
it's...
Such, yes. an un- and such a
shame.
And such an unpleasant man.
Of course. Yes.
When you meet him, he's so unpleasant.
Oh, charmless.
Deserves to be in a Black Mirror.
He's a talentless, ugly, charmless man. Obviously, I hope the irony of what I'm saying is translating because he's also he's disgustingly talented and incredibly nice.
Yes,
they're going to cut
is.
All of that last bit.
No, I won't cut all of that. No, you're absolutely right. I'm running out of time. Miley effing Cyrus is the big star of the third episode. Mm-hmm. So is Black Mirror such a global phenomenon now that everyone loves that actually it's easy to get Miley Cyrus or is it difficult to get Miley Cyrus?
We were lucky.
We were lucky.
You know, when we came up with the episode, one of the biggest challenges is casting someone who's going to be that authentic international pop star. From the beginning, they need to be a success and they need to be convincing. And that is very difficult for any actor to do, you know. And so you sort of think dream casting, you know, someone who's possibly been through a similar experience, Miley Cyrus, someone who already is known for being quite anarchic and already having strong opinions about the music industry, someone who's been on a very similar trajectory and who's tried to sort of break out of the anodyne Disney pop star mold and become an artist with her own creativity. So you sort of go, well, okay, Miley, but of course she won't do it. And we, like fools, chanced our luck. And
it was a long shot. It was like dropping a penny in one of those machines where it like bounces off pins and you lose. We thought. Yeah. We sent her the script. And
she came back we're sort of slightly in a little production bubble most of the time. So we don't even know how much of a profile the show has got in the rest of the world. But miraculously, not only had she heard of the show, she liked the show and was a big fan. And so said, yeah, I'll do it. And to her utter credit, she sort of just changed the schedule and, you know, came to Cape Town within weeks and did it with us. Fuck. Oh, sorry, I saw. Wow.
Did you actually write it with her in mind?
No, not really in that because...
That would have been so arrogant. You wouldn't just assume it.
There's a limited number of people who could have done
it. Yes, I was writing it hoping we would get a pop star, but thinking we wouldn't.
Right.
So you hope you'll get somebody who can convincingly do that side of things and has that charisma. Yeah. That's your hope, obviously. So if we hadn't got her, you know, we'd have had a real you know, job. As soon as we did get her, we were like, brilliant. And we start like ramping up the amount of, well, you'll see there's like performances in it. And she does a lot of things that I think people will find surprising, even though doing things that are quite surprising seems to be Miley's stock in trade.
Yes.
So it was just, it was very refreshing. She had a real, you know, so we had to do a Skype chat with her, which was, you know, bizarre, but equally immediately, she was very, she's just very funny, and she's got a good sense of the absurdity of the industry she's in.
Yeah.
She doesn't take things too seriously.
She doesn't take herself too seriously, and she certainly doesn't take the industry seriously.
Yeah. And so she's just, she was like, and she had lots of thoughts and observations on it. So it was immediately you thought, oh, this is great. She really responded to it. So I think it will surprise people.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. I mean, the tone of it is it's unusual, and it goes to some dark places. It's also quite a romp. So it's just, it's a, an o- another odd one for Black Mirror. I mean, they're all outliers in a way.
Yeah.
That's what we love about Black Mirror.
Yeah, it's fun. It's sarcastic and it's satirical and it's fun and it's a romp, but it's got some sort of dark concepts weaving through it.
Bit of sadness mixed in there. Oh. Bit of sadness on your popcorn. Sweet and salt. That's the best combination of popcorn, isn't it?
I'm fully in agreement with that. Mm. Thank you so much. We have run out of time. I could talk about this for the rest of the night, but sadly, we have run out of time. Thank you, Annabelle and Charlie.
Thank you.
That was Charlie Brooker and Annabelle Jones. I should point out at this point that for at least 5 minutes before that interview began, Charlie Brooker gave us a potted history of his life at Computer Exchange.
He did. This was the nerdgasm for you.
Which was an unexpected bonus.
Yeah, as my technical assistant setting up the equipment. Yeah. He was very excited about the Computer Exchange chat.
It was off mic and off interview, so I don't feel I can reveal what he said, but it was quite shocking.
It was amazing.
Tell me.
We'll tell you after the show.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But can we just say, so they always do this with Black Mirror, by the way, so they embargo it. And I think the main reason we would be reviewing it, you know, if we could.
We would.
In full. But I think what they don't like anyone giving anything away.
Yep.
Until it arrives on the day. So everyone's embargoed from fully reviewing it until it arrives on Wednesday.
What can we say?
Well, I think what we can say...
Can I just point out how irritating that is? Because, like... Well, sorry, but we James, stop laughing. We do this for a living and we don't give out spoilers. So actually, maybe if Netflix trusted us to do our jobs properly and not just presumed we're going to go and spunk spoilers all over the internet.
But will we?
Welcome to my new regular, Spunk Spoilers.
You're right. But we can say there's three new episodes.
Yep.
One of them is called Smithereens and stars Andrew Scott and Damson Idris and Topher Grace. The second is called Rachel, Jack and Ashley 2 and stars actual Miley Cyrus. As a pop star. And it's quite a satirical look at the world of being a global pop star in this day and age, and it's fascinating. And the third one is Striking Vipers with Anthony Mackie and Yahya Abdul-Mateen, and that is about kind of about the intersection of computer games, kind of porn and sexuality. And I'm saying it now, and I think we can say this much, it's fucking fascinating. And I was so intrigued by the episodes. My intrigue was genuine when I was talking to them in that interview.
Yeah.
And the Andrew Scott one is I think, again, because I'm not giving anything away, I'm not reviewing it in full, but I think we can say without breaking the embargo, there is a really tense, interesting, focused scene which mostly takes place in his car. He's like an Uber-style driver. So I'm saying that much about this.
Look at Boyd playing fast and loose with the embargo. Living on the edge.
I've talked to this about it. So they don't want people to give anything away, but... That's why I'm saying, and it arrives on Wednesday, and obviously,
and you're saying
Black Mirror fans,
people should watch it.
Black Mirror fans will go watch it, and they'll love it.
So should we have a pick of the week? What would the pick of the week be? Let's throw Black Mirror into the mix. What is the pick of the week?
Oh, Boyd. It's a good week. I mean, it's got to be Killing Eve, because
Killing Eve. Yeah,
I'm one for Killing Eve as well. Shall we have some Banshee? Shall we in the Banshee segment, which I feel obliged to explain for new listeners, is where we take an old show and recommend it for our current listeners.
Well, is that the definition, James? Take an old show and recommend it? Wasn't it meant to be an old show you may not have heard
the
of?
The amount of grief I took on Twitter this week for doing bloody Marcella last week. Okay, so the Banshee was originally, as with the show Banshee, it was for us to pull out shows that maybe our listeners hadn't, well, they might have heard of, but they hadn't seen. So it'd be something they almost certainly hadn't seen. So, yes,
like
rarities, but not stuff completely. He did fucking Red Riding!
Marcella
is a show on ITV primetime.
It isn't old.
I feel like,
it's still going.
As someone who didn't even know the name of her own Banshee last week, you do not have the moral high ground here.
we've ridden roughshod over. I mean, no one knows anymore whether it's a valid banshee
right,
or not.
All right, but let me just lay out the rules. The rules right now. God. Banshee. The rules are these. It must, right, from now on, it must be a show that is no longer on the air. Okay,
right.
So that disqualifies Marcella instantly.
Agreed.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So it must be a show that's no longer on the air. It must be a show that is good. So you've got to be recommending it in some fashion. Duh. So it can't be something rubbish. You know, ideally, something that's a bit old and a bit maybe obscure. But
ideally? These are either fucking rules or they're not rules. You can't just like go, so far we've got it should be good and no longer on the telly.
All right. Rules. So continuing the rules of Banshee. So it's something that's no longer on. It's something we're recommending, something old, something that we assume people won't have seen. So it can't be, you can't like Banshee Deadwood, for example, because that would be ridiculous. Because it's...
Or Marcella.
I think you overstate how many people watch Marcella.
Oh, you only go me for Red Riding. A lot of people have not heard of Red Riding. I'm sorry. Anyway, I'm going straight in. So I'm picking
Stick
damages.
To the rules.
I'm picking damages, right? I don't know.
What? You can't fucking pick damages. Banshee off.
I'm backing Boyd up. I think damages...
It's finished.
Not enough people watched
it. It started over 10 years ago.
I'm sorry. There is a difference between most people didn't watch it and not enough people watched it.
Didn't it air on a random channel?
Yeah, it aired on BBC Two late at night.
Yes.
Late at night, 10 o'clock, randomly.
I thought it was on a random
I can't wait to hear what Terry's Banshee is, by the way.
I'm going to Google this shit while we're...
Wasn't it on like Living or something? Was it on BBC Two?
It moved around. It was on
BBC Two for a bit.
Damages. Fucking, how can it be damaged? I mean, Glenn Close, what is wrong
with
you?
It's not about the quality of the cast.
Some people haven't seen it.
Oh my God. Guys, I'm going to Banshee... LA Law, how about that?
I mean, that would be fine.
Haven't you already banshed?
No, I haven't banshed.
You've banshed some incredibly famous shows. I can't believe it. Right, what's your one then?
Sorry,
anyway, let me quickly say, Damages starred Glenn Close, Rose Byrne, and it was really good, and Ted Danson, it was really good. And it was a legal thriller drama, which played with time a lot, and it was great, and
it
you might not have seen
good.
It.
Yes.
Thank you. Right, Terry, what's yours? Come on.
In Living Colour.
Oh, that's an incredibly famous sketch show. Yeah, African American sketch show that everyone's heard of.
Watch it. There you go.
I mean, we can all say that.
Is that your banshee? Yeah. Is that
it's
done?
Now like find the most obscure show in the world ever.
I feel like Funny or Die has been torpedoed by you two. We've got fucking the banshee segments now under siege.
I think the banshee segment is ended.
Oh,
I think
editorial decision.
It hasn't.
Live editorial decision.
How many more shows are there left to Banshee?
I'm going to say to you right now. The only reason you don't want to do Banshee anymore is you have run out of shows to talk about.
I run out on week two.
I could keep going for at least another 2 years.
I mean, if you're just listing shows that have been on the telly, then yes, you will
there
be able
so
to go.
There are so many great shows of yore that people
go
have
on.
Not
of
seen.
Of yore.
Oh my God. Guys, shows,
this
the
reminds
rule
me.
Is shows of yore.
This reminds me of John Cleese going, I opined this week on Twitter.
Oh my God, I opined.
Have you opined on shows of yore?
But when we first started doing this, like we chatted out a bunch. I remember I did Ultraviolet and Kindred the Embraced in 1 week.
Well, what are you doing this week anyway?
All right, I am doing Justified.
Okay.
It's Boyd approval. Can I do that, Terry? Can I do Justified?
What is it?
Oh, you don't even know what it is. I think that instantly says it's right. Right, so this was crime drama with Timothy Oliphant. Yeah, there's something in this view. Pay attention. So it was based on a short story by Elmore Leonard. It was an FX show, ran for, I want to say, 6 seasons. It was 2010 it started, so it ended around 2015. And he was Deputy US Marshal Raylan Givens, who was kind of known for this cowboy affectation that included like a Stetson. And he's reassigned.
He opined.
He is reassigned from years of yore to...
Oliphant opined about years of yore.
He is reassigned to Harlan, Kentucky, which is like his hometown, where his father is kind of embedded with the hillbilly mafia and his best friend, or former best friend, Boyd Crowder, played by the ever excellent Walton Goggins, is kind of leader of the local crime gang, and the streets run with Oxy. So they started out as a kind of like case of the week type thing. It was actually quite dull, but they kind of abandoned that, and it became this really properly episodic show with these wide series long storylines. Graham Yost was the showrunner, who also worked on The Americans, and it had really, really good series villains. It had Neil McDonough was in one, Michael T. Williamson, Margot Martindale was brilliant in this as well. But, and this is notable, this is for you, Terry, this may be the first time anyone saw Caitlin Dever from Booksmart.
Really?
Yes, because she played Loretta McCready in this, which is why when I watched Booksmart, I was like, oh my God, it's you from Justified. So there you go.
Good.
So that's justified. It was very, very good. And you can pick up all six seasons on DVD for £15.
Brilliant. Classic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's super cheap.
And that was the end of this week's Banshee, a segment which, I've got to be honest with you, is not going anywhere. And if you... Right, okay, I'm going to say this. If you wish Banshee to continue, please tweet at @PilotTVMag. No, in fact, don't. Please tweet at @Terry_White with the hashtag #SaveBanshee.
Terry is throwing chocolate bites.
And inform her in 280 characters. Stop throwing sweets at me. Inform her in 280 characters or less why you
please
think she's wrong.
Too.
Why she's Terry wrong and bites. Banshee should continue forever.
Or if you think Banshee is bollocks, then tweet at @JamesCDyer, @Terry_White, and @BoydHilton.
All right.
And tell James why Banshee should die.
Okay. So tweet Terry with #SaveBanshee. I got a mouthful of sweet, sorry. Or tweet me with the #Banshee is bollocks. And we will count them up at the end, the Banshee is bollocks versus the Save Banshee. And we will make a call as to whether or not Banshee continues.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Fair enough. I could tell this either way. Oh. James is masticating.
Sorry.
James is what?
Masticating. Terry threw a chocolate bar at me, and instead of throwing it back at her, I just ate it. Right. I think at this point, we can pretty much say that is it for another episode of the Pilot TV podcast. I mean, you know the drill by now. iTunes, rating, 5 stars, please. Thanks very much. Do follow us on Twitter @OurNames, because really, each of us only draws meaning from life thanks to the validation afforded by our social media audiences. Incidentally, this is why Boyd is so upbeat all the time, because if I had 100 large Twitter followers, I'd be fucking happy too.
Hundy Large.
Hundy Large. What's he's got Hundy large followers.
What are you talking about?
That's how many followers you got on Twitter. A Hundy Large.
Really, have I?
What is a Hundy Large?
Did you ever watch Californication?
No. How much is a Hundy Large?
Well, it's funny enough, clearly you weren't listening when I banshee'd it a few weeks ago.
How many is a Hundy Large?
It's 100,000.
I haven't got 100,000.
You do.
Boyd, have you got 100,000?
No, it's about 70,000,
80,000. Oh, poor you. Are you all right? Do you need a hug?
I'm going to check it out, Boyd. How many do you think you've got?
I think I've got maybe about 72,000, maybe.
More than you, Terry.
You can tell. You're the loser in this room.
That's why I'm so grumpy all the time.
77,500, Boydie.
Okay. How many do you have, Terry?
22,500.
I may have
James.
11 or something.
Numbers don't matter. Metrics don't matter.
Can everyone who follows Boyd please also follow me? I think that's only fair. And unfollow Terry because she doesn't like Banshee.
That's it.
Twitter wars. Let's do this. Right. I honestly need to get away from you two. So please join us next week for a selection of yet to be decided shows, but which will very likely include a Big Little review of Big Little Lies Season 2. And that is the truth. Pilot out. Do you want to order a sandwich or something? Anything you need to do before we start?
I'm going to pop tea in your face and watch your face burn.
You've got to put that in.